my officers wouldn't have to turn their backs on people and return to the squad car to run their driver's license. They can do it right there on an app on their phone. This is how we've progressed very quickly with technology in our profession.
Veritone presents Adventures in AI, the podcast that dives into the many ways artificial intelligence is shaping our future for the better. I'm your host, Megan Minchev, and today we're going to be taking a deeper look into trust, transparency, and law enforcement. Earlier this year, Veritone had commissioned a national survey which took a look at a wide-ranging set of questions regarding transparency in the use of technology by our country's law enforcement agencies. And then these findings were recently published in a 2021 U.S. Law Enforcement Agency Trust and Transparency Report. The report highlights that public misconceptions about policing sometimes occur due to a lack of understanding about operations, lack of access to records, or even how law enforcement agencies manage and retain those records. With better technology and objective data leading the way, law enforcement agencies have the opportunity to now shine a light on their operations and answer the public's call for increased transparency. So to further deep dive into the Trust and Transparency Report, Veritone and Microsoft recently hosted a panel discussion with law enforcement leaders from across the country to discuss the report's findings, as well as other related topics, of course, and to really dissect and understand what it means for our nation's law enforcement agencies and what those next steps are. So let's take a listen to that panel and see what was discussed.
We're pleased to have our partner Microsoft join us on this virtual panel. I'd like to introduce one of today's moderators, Kirk Lonbaum. Kirk is the former CIO for the state of Illinois. He's also held executive leadership roles within the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. And today, Kirk is the Director of Public Safety and Justice Solutions at Microsoft. Kirk, I'll hand it off to you.
Good morning, and thank you all for joining today. It's going to be a really exciting conversation with some really distinguished folks today. Just a few moments about Microsoft. You know, Microsoft's overall mission is to empower every person and organization on the planet to achieve more. And for us, that means going deep into public safety and justice. Microsoft is committed to supporting the public safety and justice community and through webinars such as this, as well as the work we do within Microsoft, as well as our ecosystem of partners. I think we're really doing that across the country and really across the globe. We have several key focus areas in Microsoft. One is for public safety and justice. One is mitigating cybersecurity risks. And we believe cybersecurity is, in fact, a public safety problem. Enabling investigations and analysis, transforming emergency response, providing real-time collaboration across police organizations as well as other stakeholders in emergency management and emergency services are things that we're really focusing on. I'd like to take just a moment to introduce our moderator today. Another distinguished person on our panel is Chief Joel Schultz. Joel's a retired police chief, an award-winning writer, college professor, trainer, and first responder chaplain. Joel is going to be our moderator today and talk us through quite a few issues on transparency today, address your questions, and really help overall guide the group. Our panel today is made up of quite a few folks. I'm really pleased to be here with them. Chief Stephen Cass Stevens is the chief of Buffalo Grove Police Department in Illinois. Chief Cass Stevens is also past president of the IACP. George Cisneros from Anaheim, California Police Department. Chief John Lutney from the Thomasville, Georgia Police Department, and John is the incoming president of the IACP. I'd like to really get right to the topics of interest, and so Joel, if you would take us away.
Thanks, Kirk. Yeah, and just to remind us, when we talk about the whole panoply of technology that we're kind of zeroing in today on the issue of transparency, what are public expectations in regard to technology, and how can technology facilitate that? The first thing that I want to ask of the panel is, we kind of have an assumption that all of our viewers today, administrators or specialists, have a basic working knowledge of what we're even talking about when we're talking about technology. Could I ask some of you to talk about what artificial intelligence is as it relates to public safety technology, and also maybe give some examples of technology. I don't see anybody with any grayer hair than mine. I first was sworn in 1978 when we still had some state agencies that had to do a hand search to find a license plate, and when walkie-talkies were about the size of a shoebox. And so that's my foundation of law enforcement technology, which you will now find at the National Law Enforcement Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. What are we talking about when we're talking about technology as it applies to public safety and as it applies to transparency for the public?
Well, that's a great question and a great way to introduce it, Joel, of hand-checking driver's licenses and license plates. In the past, I remember looking up license plates through microfiche, and I don't think a lot of cops right now know even know what that is. But then fast forward, I've now been in this profession 45 years. Fast forward today, and recently I was looking at technology for our officers that includes an app that an officer can open the camera, scan the barcode of somebody's driver's license outside on a traffic stop or on the scene of a crime, and it will return all the driver's license data right on their phone, and including checking warrants and prior hits on the person. And this is not only great technology, but I looked at it for an officer safety issue, because my officers wouldn't have to turn their backs on people and return to the squad car to run their driver's license. They can do it right there on an app on their phone. This is how we've progressed very quickly with technology in our profession.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I would say that obviously we're talking about fingerprints, and back in the days we'd have to send our officers back into the station to fingerprint them, so we can definitely do that in the field today just using a cell phone, placing some fingers on the cell phone and using the camera to be able to identify individuals today. I think we also use it through automated license plate readers. That's kind of the artificial intelligence that we use. And we use facial recognition to assist us in identifying individuals, just getting the investigative portion started. I think all of these things are extremely beneficial and have had an evolution in law enforcement, not only in, you know, making our profession even better, but also it builds trust in how you implement those and making sure that the trust that you get from your community coming forward is by educating them and moving this forward together, and not just one day showing up and start using all this stuff, and then they start asking those questions like, you know, how's this used, and is Big Brother watching us, and so forth. So I think technology does have a place in policing, and has had a place in policing, and will continue to have a place.
Well, let me ask you, Chief Cisneros, and Chief Letney, I'm sure that you'll have some follow-up as well, but what do you think that law enforcement ought to do in terms of the privacy issues that you've mentioned with ALPRs and even having driving license information on phones? Do you have, or would you recommend, or is there a standard of care for advising the public about what information is released? I, for example, when we come to automatic license plate readers, a lot of people think that the machine is actually printing out the whole stuff, you know, your name and address and all that kind of stuff, instead of pinging. So can you address that?
Yeah, I think it's a requirement on our part to educate our community when we're starting to use technology for the betterment of our community. And so I think it's important for us to get in front of our community and be able to educate them as to what this does and what it doesn't do, the safeguards that we've put in place to make sure that anything that we're using is not penetrated by individuals that should not have the ability to have those things. And so I think my thing is that we need to educate our community, and this starts before you start implementing certain things, is to make them aware of the things that you're moving forward, give them an ability to have a voice as far as, hey, this is what we hear, will this occur or not occur? And I just go back to education. It's important to engage with your community. I also would state that you also have to engage with your personnel, because at times they also are like, you know, they're not sure of the technology that we bring forward. Not all technology is directly impacting communities. It may also assist us in where we put our personnel strength and so forth. So I think it's important for us to educate both our internal people and obviously those that we serve.
All right, thank you. John, I charged ahead and didn't give you a chance to talk about these issues yet. What's on your mind?
Well, so I would just add to that. It's important to have a culture of integrity and a culture of ethics in your organization. You should have that anyway in any law enforcement agency. And that starts with hiring the right people. It goes from there to train, to supervise, to hold accountable. And with so much technology, there's so much information that we have at our fingertips, we have to use that information in an ethical manner to advance public safety, to protect people's rights, to protect their privacy. And so we need to have good policies in our organization that gives guidance to our staff for what information do we get? How do we use it? How is that most appropriate? How is it legal? You know, every state will have their privacy laws and what's a public record and what's not. Things that you have to release, things that you may release, and things you cannot release. And we need to know that and make sure we build into that technology as much safeguarding as we can and have good policies around it so we're using it appropriately, we're releasing it appropriately, and that has to go across the board. There is so much more technology out there now than there ever was, as was mentioned. And we don't know what will be brought up, what will be invented in the next 6 months, year, 5 years, 10 years. But we know technology will continue to advance. And with that, we have to be on the forefront of using it appropriately and making sure, again, we have those safeguards in place.
And Joel, I appreciate just to add to that real briefly, and it's important, some of the points that John made, but at the end of the day, this is what we're here talking about. We're talking about transparency. And if I'm the chief of a law enforcement agency and I'm going to roll out some new technology, whether it be ALPRs or any kind of technology that gathers data, I need to be upfront with my community. The last thing you want is a group showing up at your city council meeting being upset because they want to know why weren't we told that the police department's now doing XYZ. And so it's incumbent upon us to be transparent. If we're coming up with a new use of technology, we should be the first ones that are going public at our city council talking about our new technology and how it's being used and what our policies are to protect the data and to make sure our residents don't feel like it's a Big Brother gathering data on them. So again, we're here talking about transparency, and that's exactly what's important.
So it sounds like the strong implication is that there needs to be an underlying foundation of trust in the community as a predicate to saying, okay, now we have this, so that you don't get the eye rolls and, you know, what's my police department up to now? It's been great to see the many surveys of public confidence and trust in policing that is still very much higher than we might think from the last few years of tarnishing of the police profession. And I just wonder, this isn't necessarily a technology question, but how have you gauged in your agencies the level of trust? And is that something that ought to be undertaken before we roll out these other things that might that might cause some questions in the public? Did I talk too much? I sometimes slip into professor mode.
No, not at all. I'll be brief with my answer, and I'm not sure about Chief Letney and Cesaros, but my police department is accredited. And part of your accreditation requires you to do community surveys and satisfaction surveys. How does your community feel about the police department? How do they feel about the response times? How do they feel about the interactions with law enforcement officers? And I would say it's incumbent upon every agency, whether you're accredited or not, to do that exact thing. You have to know how your community feels about your law enforcement agency, about how you manage your budget, about how you hire personnel, how you train your officers. This is all important for transparency, and how would I know if my officers are doing a good job unless I ask my residents what their thoughts are?
I would certainly agree with that. I think there's both formal and informal ways to gauge that trust. As an accredited agency, yes, we do surveys every few years, and those are great formal methods, scientifically based, research based, where we can get a very good perspective on community issues, concerns, and opinions. But I think it's equally as important to do the informal surveys being part of your community, having a relationship with your community where they feel comfortable enough to talk to an officer on the street, to call a supervisor when they don't think something is going right, to stop in here and call or see me or any of my senior command staff. I know when I'm walking our downtown, which I do fairly regularly, I'll stop in and talk to the business owners, and I'll always hear good or bad, usually good, which is important, but it's having that regular form of communication. When I'm out in the neighborhoods, when I'm at the council meetings, when I'm at Neighborhood Watch, when you have a relationship with people, then they will come up to you with whatever their concern or their accolade is. And that's how you can really gauge trust, not so much on an overall community perspective, which is important, but right down to a neighborhood, to a street, to a group of people, to a household. And that's really important in what we do.
Well, I would concur with what Steve and John have stated so far. And we're going through the accreditation process also at the same time. But we live in what I define as everything is right now culture. And so we're going to use technology to be part of that, everything is right now, right? As a chief, I want to know today, how my individuals are doing today as we provide service. So we're going to use technology that is already out there in other professions, and we're actually incorporating that. We're about 2 months away where people will be able to say, how was that service when we came out to them? And they'll have a little 5 stars, and they can hit the 5 stars. And so for us, it's just a way of determining how well we're doing with our community. And what I define as, the post-social media era, in which is everything has to be today and so forth. So I commend Stephen and John for what they're doing, and we look forward to working in that same capacity.
I have a quick follow-up on that, the question of transparency and public connection. I'm curious as to your perspective on the use of social media by policing in terms of both monitoring information. We know it's valuable from an investigative perspective on major events, but in terms of a social networking perspective, I'm curious if any of you have looked into social networking type of social media programs.
And by the way, if any of you say you do department lip syncs, I may have to back out of this.
Yes, we use social media. Buffalo Grove Police is on Facebook, or on Twitter, or on LinkedIn, and I think that's incredibly important. And to go back what Chief Cisneros was talking about, I think the survey that we do of our community that's required by CALEA is great. As John said, that's more formal, but quite often that data that we get is 2 years old, and I need data quicker than that. Mm-hmm. I need to find out much sooner than that. And where I think law enforcement is still a little behind some of the rest of the world, and I look at the service industry like restaurants and hotels, you have an opportunity for immediate feedback. If you're a guest at a hotel, or if you're a patron at a restaurant, either through an app or through one of the food apps or the restaurant apps, you have immediate feedback. When I check out of Hotel XYZ, I get an email or I get a text message, how was your stay? They don't want me to answer that 2 years from now. They want to know that right now. And I think that's where law enforcement, we have an opportunity to use technology better to get more immediate feedback. How was my officer's work when they responded to your traffic crash? Were you satisfied? Did you get the information you need? I think that's where we need to go.
I totally agree with you, Stephen. That's the direction that we're trying to move towards. That we're almost there. We had a three-phase approach to this, and we're about just 2 months away to really pushing that out. One of the things I saw during 2020 with the unfortunate incident that happened in Minneapolis. Obviously, we had protests and demonstrations and so forth. And one of the things we did was we went into social media and reported live during this period of time. And that has become part of our department response to when it comes to these critical incidents, is to really start to address those from early stages. Now, obviously, during investigations, there's some limitations as to what you can and cannot put out there. But there is opportunities for us to give as much information. Again, this is about transparency, and we have to be transparent as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't want to give away information that will stop investigations or impact investigations, but we have an opportunity. It's going to take us a little while, and I'm from that era, right, that you hold things really tight and close, and we'll give you the response when we're ready to give you the response. But ladies and gentlemen, that era is gone. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have kids, and many of us have kids, and you ask them, when was the last time you checked out, you know, your local news on the TV, and they're like, if it isn't on the phone, I don't know anything about it. And so I think that's kind of at least impacted me as to how I lead an organization in this current century.
I agree with all that. I think social media is a great opportunity to get our message out the way we want our message to be out, and to talk with our community directly. And there are so many different platforms out there. We use about four or five of them here. And I find that depending on the platform, you're hitting a segment of your community. You can't, you know, be on one platform and hit everybody. Some hit, you know, different segments, different demographics, different age groups. So you've got to be on multiple platforms, and you've got to have a consistent message. And that's somewhat difficult, but you've got to really be deliberate about that. And you've got to make sure that you're relevant and you're regular. You can't put out a post on name the platform, you know, once every other week and expect people to have that as one of your go-tos for information. So when the emergency happens, you know, the issues that we saw over the last year or so, or even some sort of other emergency, you want to be that go-to. So I use social platforms like that in our emergency operations center during hurricanes, where we will make that our go-to for report, ask questions. Now, you have to have a person dedicated to answering those, because you've got to have regular feedback. But when we can get information from our community about things that are going on, we can now strategically respond to, be that police, fire, EMS, public works, public utilities, whatever it is. We are serving our community better, more efficiently, and more strategically. But you've got to be focused on it. You got to be deliberate, and you've got to understand that your community wants that connection. They want to be able to reach you, speak with you, get an answer from you. And as was said, it's almost an immediate world. The 24-hour news cycle is a real thing, and we've got to get information out on a regular basis. And social media is a great way to do that. We have to also be aware of the downsides. And sometimes the message comes out in a way that we don't intend, or it gets misinterpreted, or it gets put in a way, you know, clipped and snipped and so on, that is not what we originally intended. So you also got to monitor that and make sure that your message is the way you want it to be. And we learn a lot from our community and looking at other social media pages, linking to chambers of commerce, linking to other leaders in the area, and getting that feedback and information. Where we can once again use that and leverage our ability to interact with folks in a way that you just can't do one-on-one necessarily, you know, certainly with a small staff.
Gentlemen, this is Mike from
no better example of that one than it's been a few years now, but when the Boston Marathon bombing happened, Boston PD had already done a great job of establishing themselves on social media, and things after the Boston Marathon bombing were happening so quickly, they didn't have personnel at the station to answer the phones and call back the media and call, but they had already established our social media page is the single place to go to get updated information, whether it's from the media or whether it's for their citizen. And they had to, because they had done such a great job leading up to that, that social media was very successful for them in managing the information from the bombing.
Gentlemen, this is Mike from Veritone. I'm monitoring questions coming in from the audience, and there's a great one very much related to this particular topic. The question is, maybe you can generalize this. In respect to social media, do your agencies just post static information for public viewing and commenting, or do you have conversations with the public through the commenting system, whether, you know, good, bad, or ugly? Anyone care to comment on that?
I'd say it's a little of both. We try to put out information that not only is timely and relevant, so a crime in progress, a wreck scene that we want people to avoid, the intersection or the area, things like that, but, you know, also positive stuff, you know, things we're doing in the community, our school resource officers in the schools, our Halloween and other events, and, you know, all those kind of things where we're doing community outreach. It's great to show those things that you're doing, but you also got to be prepared for the questions, the comments, and so on. And when you answer them in a professional, polite, positive manner, generally what I found is the social media community will take care of themselves. There's going to be the naysayers. There's going to be the people that just don't like anything of what you're doing. But the folks that appreciate it, the people that want and expect and deserve good law enforcement will come to your defense in some ways. And it's shown to me to be a very good tool to get information out, to humanize the badge, but also to interact. And you do have to understand that there are going to be some people that just don't appreciate that.
Related to the same general thread, comments that you've all shared have been very consistent with the findings that we learned in the survey we did earlier this year. That survey that I mentioned, 74% of the respondents said they get information from their local law enforcement agency through the social channels, through the YouTube channels. And I can tell you, as personally looking through the data, it's directly associated with age. So the younger the cohort, one of you made a mention, I think it might have been Chief Cisneros, if it's not on the phone, it doesn't exist. So the younger the individual, the stronger the bias towards only looking to, I'll call it new media versus old media, where newspapers, local TV, they are just not used anymore. It is all social media. So related to that, and knowing that they're eager to find information directly from each of you, something that we've observed is a new concept, or a relatively new concept, of transparency portals, where it's a location on the agency or the city's website where you're publishing data proactively. Curious if any of you have comment on that, what your experience has been.
Yeah, we have exactly that on our city's website. We have a transparency portal, and a lot of the information, the documents that we put in there, are from the questions we've had from the public in the past, whether it's, you know, salary information, or, you know, information on how we hire officers, how we do backgrounds, whatever it is. But there's a lot of information under our transparency portal that, frankly, 10 years ago, we would have never thought of putting on there. But again, part about transparency is, if you have nothing to hide, then put it out there. The more you can share with your residents, the more you're going to build trust with your residents. That's why we still do, after all these years, our citizen police academies. We still do those. But some of the things we share in our citizen police academy, again, we never thought of 15 years ago. We talk about our police budget in our citizen police academy, because I want our residents to know that. They have no idea what my budget looks like. How many dollars are in there? How is it spent? How much is spent on training? And then when we get into training, there are typical great questions. They're like, well, why do you train in this, 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 and this? Well, it's all mandated. It's either federally mandated or state mandated. We have to do this training. Mm-hmm. And so this is a great opportunity to educate the public, especially, I think, when it comes to budgets.
I find one of the most asked for information in that kind of portal is crime mapping. People mm-hmm. want to know what's going on in their neighborhood, or people right. who want to move to our community, or realtors, or you name it, if they're going to open a business or whatever, they want to know the incidence of crime. And most people don't understand the facts, or make their judgment based upon the factual incidence of crime, because they don't know. So they either feel safe or they don't feel safe for whatever reason. But if we can put out information through crime mapping on a public-facing portal like a website where people can drill down into whatever area they want to and look at the factual incidents of crime, they will have a better idea of what's really going on. They will be able to make more informed decisions if that's what they come there for. But they also will be better prepared to protect themselves, help us protect them, work with us, and maybe prevent crime. So, for example, if someone knows that in their neighborhood there's been a bunch of cars broken into for whatever reason, when we come off with a message, be it in public presentations, through the media, through social media, lock your cars, remove your valuables, then it may resonate a little more because they can look down and say, well, okay, what's going on in my neighborhood? It may be important citywide or countywide or whatever to them, but what's most important? It's what's going on in their neighborhood. So we have that information when we put it out there, when we have good crime analysis, when we take all this information data we get and we do something with it, then we have something that we can provide to our community that helps them be safer.
You know, just a quick follow-up on additional transparency. One of the things Microsoft and many of our partners are working with police agencies on in the transparency area is use of force. I'm really interested in your perspective on transparency and use of force. You know, the PERF study recently found that increasing public trust in the police was the number one priority of chiefs across the country. Mm-hmm. I think use of force is a big part of that. So, really interested in your thoughts on that topic.
Well, you've hit on my favorite topic, Kurt, because for several years now, I have been repeating the same message to law enforcement agencies across this country. Even though it's voluntary, you absolutely have to report your monthly data to the FBI's use of force database. I'm not sure this day and age why any police chief, sheriff, state police director would not do this. Now, you look back, the Washington Post, and they seem to revisit this topic every year, and just this past June, they did again. And the Post said for the second year, most U.S. police departments declined to share information on use of force. And then many of you probably saw it just yesterday. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette did a similar story mm-hmm. on law enforcement agencies who are not contributing data to the use of force database. And in Pennsylvania, only 1% of the law enforcement agencies in the state of Pennsylvania are reporting their use of force data. As a police chief, I don't understand this. And here's why I believe it's so important. First of all, any statistician will tell you, if you're going to analyze data and come to conclusions, but you're telling me you're only utilizing 26% of the available data, your data is worthless. You're not telling the true story. And for how many consecutive years in a row has part of the conversation regarding law enforcement in this country been use of force? What are the true numbers of use of force? For years, the single entity that tracked use of force the best was the Washington Post. Not a federal law enforcement agency, not a state law enforcement agency, even the media, which is unacceptable. And so now we have an opportunity for years now to report use of force data. And what's most important, I talk to a lot of the chiefs across the country, and so many of them say, I haven't had a deadly use of force incident in 5 years. That's the most important piece of data we need to report. Then every month, your agency should be reporting zeros into that database. And the more agencies we have reporting zeros, the more accurate that data is, and the more we're going to be able to tell the true story on the frequency of use of force, and more important, use of deadly force by law enforcement agency across the country. But right now, less than 40% are reporting. I find that unacceptable.
Well, Chief, let me give you one of my pet peeves here, and it's aligned with what you just mentioned, is we don't study our successes and we don't publish our successes very well. We know how many shootings there were for the most part, but my survey, along with another one that was published in the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin several years ago, shows how many, 70 to 80% of officers within any given two-year period must make a deadly force decision. Most of them don't pull the trigger, but most of our officers on a reasonably regular basis are choosing less than lethal options, and we're really statistically very successful at that, but that message is not there. The other concern that I have, and I've done a lot of writing and researching and activism on police officer victimization, the national statistics that I see quoted even with police officer advocacy organizations is we have 50,000 police officers injured every year. That does not scratch the surface. That is so severely and dramatically underreported. And police officers themselves, based on the survey information that I conducted, a lot of officers don't admit that they're injured. They'll go to the ER 2 days later. They want to walk it off like their old football days. So, you know, it kind of brings us to a point, perhaps, or at least in my mind, this idea of sharing information, as you all, I think most of you have expressed, is kind of foreign to my generation, and my generation trained the generation that's coming, and the generations that's coming have established the academy training standards. So we're really in a lot of legacy training and a lot of legacy subculture indoctrination. So I say all that to say this. I always felt my job as a police officer was to keep the public from having to deal with all the crap that I am paid to deal with. And so confidentiality or opaqueness as opposed to transparency, I thought was a public service, just like I shielded my family. I left the job at the gate and didn't talk about it. People would ask my wife, what happened over in so-and-so? I don't know. Joel doesn't tell me anything. And everybody has to negotiate that within their own family. But so the question is, are we able to enculturate a sense of transparency in our workforce who's out there gathering the data and using the data? Are we at a leadership level recognizing something and imposing something that is against the gut feeling of our street officers? Is there a disconnect there?
To answer your question, I think, I'll give you an example. The best way I can maybe define this is body-worn cameras. You know, body-worn cameras, and we started using body-worn cameras in 2014. And, you know, we had a big push from most of our personnel that they didn't want the body-worn cameras, they didn't want people to see what they were doing, and so forth. But the reality is it's been an extreme benefit for policing. It's one of the greatest technologies that we, in our era, in our time, that has been used. And it has actually shown the professionalism of our profession in the sense of how we interact with our community and so forth. And that's not to say we don't have issues and we have to correct those issues. But if you can recall, you know, before a one-on-one situation with a non-sustained disposition, right? With a body-worn camera, those things have changed dramatically. What used to be the norm, a non-sustained issue, a one-on-one contact, now has become very minimal because now you have this assistance of that. And so I think, and we were talking about use of force, and even complaints, all of those things I think are extremely important now. As long as we keep the privacy of our employees intact, I think they will come forward and move forward with us in that direction. We have a new generation of individuals, and I think we're learning from them. If you think you can change them, that's you're mistaken. That's not going to happen. We have had to evolve, and many of us here today, just by the look, we have definitely had to evolve, right? Because many of us started when we were right, we had a revolver on our hip. Right, we wrote reports. The biggest technology was whiteout, and then came erasable ink pens, beepers. DNA was in infancy stages. We didn't start with the website or email, right? And all of these things. So we've adapted, and I think we will continue to adapt. And I think that's what's great about this profession is that we're able to adapt with the new conditions that we have to work under.
Chief Cisneros,
a great point, Chief, because I recall on my former department, I was one of the first officers that got an in-car squad video. And we had the same issue that now a lot of agencies are in with body cameras. You have a certain number of officers like, I don't want that. I don't want everybody to see. But in the short period of time after my former agency went to in-car cameras, about the fifth or sixth citizen complaint that was proven false because we happened to have video and audio, suddenly the officers realized maybe this is a pretty good thing after all. And there were some officers says, I'm willing to pay for my own camera myself. So we're back there again, doing that same education to a different generation of officers now on the importance of body cameras. And I think it's an easier lift now because of so much other technology than it was back in the days that we implemented squad car cameras.
Same experience that officers were a little reluctant early on with in-car video and body camera, but now it's such a norm and an expectation. And the research shows that people act better, be they officers or citizens, when they know they're being video recorded. And when that happens, it's a better interaction for everyone. And so if the interaction doesn't go well, we have video of it, and we also have to understand that the video doesn't show everything. It shows a lot, but it doesn't show everything. So we have to do a full investigation. But that video is a crucial piece to it. It also helps us with training, with identifying issues that we need to work on. We're showing officers that do things really well and using that as a model. But key to that also is not just looking at them when you get a complaint. Your supervisor should be regularly monitoring. You should have a policy in place that every month the supervisor has to view X amount of videos from his or her staff members and look at that. Not only are they doing things right, is the camera system working correctly? Are they turning it on when they should? Are they turning it off when they're allowed? And are they handling things properly? And then what training tools do we learn from that? And we found in many cases, we can enhance officer safety by showing that officer that video of how he or she conducted, for example, a traffic stop and where they may have put themselves at risk. And they learn from that. They're safer. They do a better job. And it's technology that I think is universally accepted in the profession. And I think that's a good thing.
Gentlemen, on the same topic, we asked a question about where investment should go in law enforcement. And the number two source of recommendation was body-worn camera programs. So clearly the public believes that this is a great way of helping to demonstrate transparency. Those of you that do have BWC programs, we've got a number of individuals listening to us right now that are not part of law enforcement. Maybe you could share some perspective on what it means to be able to release that footage. There's definitely some unintended consequence of collecting all of this information. For those of you that have those programs, do you care to comment on what that process is like and maybe areas for improvement?
And Mike, I might also insert, how is artificial intelligence helping in reviewing and editing that material?
You know, I can start and tell you that obviously privacy issues is a main concern. And when we started this, we had to do labor. It was man hours, and usually it was about 4 hours for every hour of video. And now with redaction software out there using artificial intelligence, this has tremendously helped us and made us a little bit more efficient and effective and fiscally responsible. And so those tools have definitely assisted us using body-worn camera video and ability when we get PRA for some of this stuff, then we have the ability to provide that information as quickly as possible, again, though, in a more effective and fiscally responsible manner. And this is just the evolution as we move forward. Artificial intelligence is part of the technology that we use in that component and many other components, and I think it's important for us to continue to look into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. The software that has allowed us to redact or you know, skip through and pick the salient parts of a video has been very helpful. It is very labor intensive. When you think of an officer on a 12-hour shift and how much video he or she will bring in every day, multiply that by the number of days in the week, the month, the year, the officers you have, there is so much video that that we have, and it becomes very expensive. So buying the camera is actually the cheap part of the solution. It's the storage, and then how long do you keep it? Do you have an in-house server? Do you have a backup server? Are you using cloud-based? There's a lot of things you got to work through. But then I think you also have to have a really good understanding of the public records laws in your state, your province, your nation, and what becomes public. I go back to what I said before. What can you release? What must you release? And what can't you release? And in some states, you cannot release police video short of a court order. In other states, you can release all of it. But then you have to make the decision of at what point. Should I release it now, right after the critical incident? Will it impair the investigation? Do I have privacy concerns for the public or for my staff? You know, officers have a right to privacy too under certain circumstances, and there's a lot of competing interests. So understanding those laws, working through those, and then being transparent about what you will do when is very important. And don't wait till the critical incident. Have a policy, have your staff involved in so they understand when a video will be released, because they're going to be on it, and have those conversations with your community so they know when you're going to release it and when you're not going to release it. And to make those decisions at the time of the critical incident is not ideal. You want to work through all those issues up front, use the technology to its full advantage, use the AI to make it as efficient as you can, and then understand the circumstances about how you can be as transparent as possible.
I agree. And the only thing I would add to that is, you know, where more and more law enforcement agencies now are utilizing body-worn cameras, when you do have a critical incident, a use of force incident, the media now, that's the first thing they're going to ask for. They're going to request a copy of that video. People are going to FOIA the video. And so you, as John said, you better have that policy in place right now, and then understand with your prosecutor and your investigators, you have to strike that balance between not releasing video too soon that might jeopardize the investigation into that incident, but also being transparent and releasing the video or at least clips of that video to show you're being transparent with the public. And that's a tough balance depending on every given situation.
Yeah, I think Chief Letney, you brought up a great point that transparency does not necessarily mean we're going to release it all the time. It means good communication, letting the community know how we're going to conduct business and under what circumstances. I just wanted to comment on that. Thank you for that, for driving that home, that point.
Gentlemen, if you don't mind, I want to be mindful of some of the questions that came in before we started this session. And we had a collection of questions around the use of drones. So drones are becoming, you know, much more common in our society. I'm unclear if any of you have active drone programs. I'm sure our panelists that have IACP involvement may have some thoughts on this. Are there any best practices? Are there any pitfalls to avoid? Eager to get perspective there.
Well, the IACP does have a police aviation committee among many committees that we have, and we have some very bright and intelligent people on that committee. Who have developed a number of policies over the years. I know years ago, the Police Aviation Committee was really just the larger law enforcement agencies that either had helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft. But now the majority of what that committee addresses is police use of drones. And, you know, you look at the opportunities for drones, everything from we have a regional major crash investigations team, and they use drones to get aerial photos of fatal crash scenes to help reconstruct those crashes. We use drones to help search for lost children or elderly people. So there's a lot of very good uses for drones by law enforcement agency. But again, we go back to having a best practices policy and educating your community and being transparent on when you will or will not use drones. People want to know that you're not flying them over their backyard to see if they're growing marijuana in their garden.
So I would add that, yes, the city of Anaheim does have drones. We do have, obviously, policies and procedures, and those were first and foremost brought through one of our council meetings to educate our community Obviously, we had certain unions that had opposed. ACLU had opposed it. We had sent even our policies and procedures to them. They declined to comment at the time based on that we had reviewed previous documentation by them and had made sure that we were answering all of those questions. So we definitely have a great policy and procedure in place. Currently, our drone program is not where we want it to be. We're looking to be sight unseen drones where we can send them out to certain type of calls. And I think this is where our profession is going, is that drones will assist us in maximizing the use of our greatest commodity, which is the men and women that put on our uniform and our professional staff. And so by using drones and technology to assist us in certain type of calls that may not require a police officer to arrive, but maybe just to communicate, I think it's extremely important. I think I look forward to seeing where the drone program goes in the next few years.
And right now, Chief, your email box is being loaded with requests for your policy.
We'll get it through the drone program as well and use it for all those things that were mentioned. And in the recent past, one of the most successful uses is we were in a regional a manhunt for a suspect who had shot and killed a law enforcement officer in a very wooded area. There was probably 200 police officers from all across the region, local, county, state, and so on. And having a drone up to be the eyes and ears, eyes to try to find this armed suspect was critically important to officer safety. And drones have so many good uses. So the regional accident reconstruction team that Steve mentioned, I know many state law enforcement agencies use them to in that way. They can clear a road much more quickly. They can do the reconstruction from the air, go back and have the software do it, which means officers are safer on the ground, less chance for secondary collisions and so on. So it's all very important. But the key, again, I go back to is having good policy, as Chief mentioned, and being transparent. Letting your community know beforehand that this is what you're going to do and how you're going to use it. I know of an agency when drones first started in law enforcement that didn't do that. And the first the community heard about it was when their council was voting to approve the funding. And they already had everything ready to go, except they didn't communicate. And as a result of that, the vote didn't pass. There was a lot of community concern, and that drone program literally never got off the ground. And I think with some better communication and some better understanding, you know, new technology people can be afraid of. They don't know how it's going to be used. They don't want government to be overreaching, and they certainly don't want law enforcement to be big brother. So by arming them with facts, here's how we will use it, here's how it's advantage to public safety, I think it enhances those relationships and allows the technology to be used in the most efficient and effective way.
Thanks. Chief Castevens, I just want to make a comment. I'm in Colorado, so we don't have to fly drones to answer the question, is there marijuana in the backyard? The answer is yes.
Good point.
And Mike and Kirk, I may be asking the last question here. If you want me to yield to you, if you've got something burning in your mind to ask, it might be a good time now to keep me from taking the rest of the time.
You know, Kirk, do you have something you want to offer?
No, sir. I'm good.
Great. I did have one thing to pose before we get to the wrap-up here. In the report, we learned that 44% of respondents wanted to see their local law enforcement agencies actually increase funding for anti-racism and unconscious bias training. There's been a trend in the U.S. to start collecting perceived race and other demographic information by state legislators to help mitigate this concern. Do any of your agencies have strategies or programs in place right now related to this?
Interesting question, because the state of Illinois mandated, this was over 15 years ago, mandated every law enforcement agency in the state of Illinois to collect data on every traffic stop relative to not race, but perceived race by the officer, and including data of the reason for the stop, the result of the stop, whether it was a ticket or no ticket, whether there was a search conducted, if a search was conducted, what was found, if anything, and it collected a lot of data. And several years ago, that has then expanded to include pedestrian stop. So every officer in the state of Illinois has been collecting that data for a decade and a half, if not more. And here's what I found most interesting about this. Since that law went into effect, I have not seen one single media report where somebody looked into that data on a police department or an individual officer in that department and found that there was a pattern of practice of stopping minorities or ticketing minorities more than others, etc. I've never been afraid of collecting that data and sharing that data. That's being transparent. It's important to show the public, here's our numbers. Here's how many people we stopped. Here's the breakdown of race and the result of the stop. Happy to share that.
So I'm aware of at least one circumstance where in a state that does have that same requirement outside of Illinois, where there's a regular view of that. There's a transparency portal. And people do go in there and look at that based on agency and sometimes based on officer, and it's a random number, so they don't have names. And while that's good and it's transparent, I've seen a couple studies come out that are just flawed methodology. We cannot compare data like that to, for example, census block data, and then assume that an agency is either acting in an appropriate or inappropriate way, because those two things don't necessarily meet. The people that are subject to traffic stops in any one community may or may not reside there. They may be traveling through, they may be working there, they may be shopping or whatever. And so to compare the ratio of traffic stops to the census block data is not an accurate measurement. So while having a transparency and having the data is great, we have to have better methods to make informed, logical, accurate decisions based on those, and not jump to a false conclusion because of a flawed methodology.
Great point.
Great point by Stephen and John. And I'd just like to add, in the state of California, we are also required to gather this demographic information. Their system is somewhat flawed because it only asks certain questions. And so working with Veritone, I had the great opportunity of working with them and trying to give more context. Just like John just said, right? Sometimes just using demographic as a certain area is not enough. You need additional information to be able to really assess what the data is really telling you. And so by working with Veritone, and this is something we work where there's 18 questions, and I may be wrong on the number, but I added like 7 or 9 more questions that gave further context. And so we created this app, and that's how we're going to gather that information. We're going to share it. Because I think with further questions, my community will be able to make better decisions as to how well their organization, their police organization, is doing. And so really respect what Veritone's done for us in that sense and given us an ability to serve our community and give them the information, that transparency that we've been talking about today, real transparency, where we're giving you all the information for you to make that, at the end of the day, that the decision of whether we're providing the best service possible or not. So I truly believe in technology, and we just have to use it to the best of our capabilities.
Mike, do we need to shut down at the top of the hour here?
Yeah, I think we need to start wrapping things up, be mindful of everyone's time. Chief Schultz, if you want to go ahead and bring us home here, that'd be great.
I'm always the guy when the meeting's about over. I've got one more question.
Absolutely.
I'll pose a first of all, I hope a cable network will pick up this program for a weekly presentation. I just really enjoyed it, and I think it's very valuable. But I'll just give you a multiple choice question. What is the greatest challenge with technology in your agency? Is it interoperability? Is it obsolescence? Or is it the cost of acquisition?
Well, yes.
All three.
So in Illinois, as part of the new legislation passed this year in Illinois, among many things in police reform, we'll be mandating body-worn cameras for every law enforcement agency in the state that don't already have them. However, coupled with that is zero state funding to help law enforcement agencies afford that. And what we can't forget is that across this nation of the 18,500 or so law enforcement agencies, 70% of those are 25 officers or less.
Mm-hmm.
These are law enforcement agencies with minimal budgets, some of them struggling to put gas in their squad cars, depending on what part of the country you're in. And so for them to be mandated for the body-worn camera program is going to be a real struggle. And as John said earlier, it's not the cost of the cameras. You can almost get those free. It's the cost of managing and storing the data. It's the cost of the response for Freedom Information Act requests. It's the redaction software, cloud storage. It's all this related cost. My agency, we don't have body-worn cameras yet. They're coming very soon. But it's going to cost me probably around $800,000. And right now, I don't have any federal grants or state grants that's going to help me pay for that. Along with that, you mentioned obsolescence. Absolutely. When we replace our body cameras, I plan on replacing our squad car video cameras at the same time so they can interface. Our current squad cameras are 9 years old. I should have replaced those a long time ago, but they, much like every other law enforcement agency, we've cut budgets over the past 2 years because of revenue losses due to COVID. So to answer your question, yes, all three.
I say the same, yes to all three. Cost, obsolescence, change in technology. It's an ongoing thing that we have to prepare for and budget for.
Yeah, I would say all three. Interoperability is probably one of the main concerns. You know, as an agency that uses artificial intelligence, virtual reality, soon to come for our training components, you know, community engagement software, websites, social media platforms, overt and covert cameras, facial recognition, body-worn camera, drones, tasers, cell phones for each officer that are secured, Ripple software, we were just talking about the demographic issues, live 911, all of these things that you have, and then all of a sudden you find out, can they talk to each other? And then you start thinking about that, right? So I think it's important that that's a piece that at times we don't think about. How do these work all well together? How do they mesh work and so forth? And that's where it requires us to create that blanket that brings it all together and so forth. So I would say interoperability, but you require all three. There's definitely a component there. But interoperability for me is probably my main concern.
Well, I want to thank the chief for being on the panel today, and of course everybody that's tuned in. I feel smarter now than I did an hour ago, so thank you for that.
Now you have a better understanding and perhaps have even learned a different perspective of the U.S. law enforcement transparency and how technology helps. So thank you for taking the time to listen to Adventures in AI, the podcast that dives into the many ways artificial intelligence is shaping the future for the better. Talk with you next time.